welcome to the Daily Reprieve, where we provide essays, speaker meetings, workshops, and conferences in podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast. If you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by going to donate.thedailyreprieve.com and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Please consider donating monthly by clicking the Donate Monthly button. However, one-time donations are always welcome. Just click the Donate Now button. Now, without further ado, this episode of The Daily Reprieve.
Yep. Okay, I'd like to start off by asking each of you, just those who are willing, I'd like for you to offer me one of your affirmations, beliefs, ideas about God. Okay, just to get the idea going, I'll get it started. God is love. Okay.
God loves me.
Okay.
God is dependable. God never turns his back on you.
I'm spelling that right.
God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free.
I'm paraphrasing. Okay. Anybody got a burning desire?
God is willing to forgive me.
Thank you. That's a good one. God forgives me.
Did you say God forgives me?
He's willing to.
Okay. Now this is a brief list, and this can be, you know, this anyone can add to this. The reason I'm picking this is because what we're going to do is we're going to go through a what I refer to as a guided meditation, and rather than me using my ideas about God, don't take that personal. I just need to be able to read it. And well, actually, there we go. I can do that. And and rather than me using my concept of God, I wanted people to offer this because this way I think you can get a better sense of how this will actually work. Now, again, one of the ways of types of meditation is sitting quietly, and whenever a thought comes into your mind, just let it. You don't try to force it out. You just kind of let it go gently, push it to the side, and try to. And you're trying to listen for the voice of God. And as I said, that seems to me to be, or for me early on, that was more difficult. It still is actually more difficult. So what I'd like to do is offer a place where we can start. And for this exercise, I'd like for you to get comfortable. And if you prefer to sit on the floor, as compared to in your chair, I don't care. Whatever is going to work best for you, because we're just going to sit here quietly for a little bit, and I don't want people having to get up and move, primarily because I don't want you to disturb the people close to you. So with that being said, we'll go ahead And I'll ask you, first of all, to close your eyes. Get your feet comfortably placed on the floor. If you do have your legs crossed, I'd encourage you to uncross them because it tends to cut your circulation after a few minutes. And just sit quietly. You can close your eyes if you like, or open them, whatever. And just take a deep breath in, as deep as you can. Just fill your lungs till it almost hurts, and then let it out very slowly through your mouth. And I usually like to start with two or three deep breaths. And just notice the sensation as you fill your lungs with air, and then let it go very slowly. And now we'll consider the proposition that God is love. Just repeat to yourself. Anytime your mind starts to wander, bring it back to the idea that God is love. And perhaps as you're reflecting that God is love, you might consider what love actually means. What would that be? A commitment to your well-being? A sense of awe when your higher power considers all that you are and all that you can become? And now you might consider that God is dependable. And if God loves you and He's dependable, what does that mean? Perhaps you think of people that you've loved in the past who turned out not to be dependable. And you might consider how your experience with God might be different from your experience with people who have proven to be fallible. As you're considering this, just be aware of your breathing in and out. And now consider that your higher power wants you to be happy, joyous, and free. Perhaps if you're a parent, you might imagine your child, or if not a parent, imagine a group of children playing on a playground, safe, protected. Completely unconcerned by anything aside from the joy they're experiencing as they play together. And as you consider the joy that you feel imagining the children playing on the playground, imagine how much more your higher power must delight in watching you as you grow into the life for which you were created. As you imagine your higher power watching over you as you go through this life, filled with love and joy for the happiness that you're able to experience, imagine that higher power knows all the mistakes you've made and completely forgives you with the forgiveness that makes the love that you are receiving undiminished, complete, and unconditional. As this love pours out from our higher power, it fills the room, surrounds us, fills us, ask you to bring your awareness back to the room. Open your eyes and rejoin the group here. That is simply one type of meditation. And whether you want to call what we used a mantra or a consideration or a thought, it doesn't matter. But the work that each of you has done with your second step, and what your additional work brings you to believe about the nature of your higher power and your relationship with that power becomes material that you can use in a meditation like this. And I specifically chose this time not to use the prayer out of the 12 and 12, but in the same way, you can sit quietly and you can take the prayer itself, or you can take a specific phrase out of that, and and meditate on that, and you can do this. I'm thinking we probably spent about 15 minutes doing that. But you can do it for 5 minutes. I've got a friend who meditates about an hour each morning. I'm not sure I've ever done that long. But you know, and I'm not saying frankly, that's not a goal of mine. Okay, my goal is not to say I meditated for an hour. My goal is to make conscious contact with my higher power. And if I'm in a place where where I've got 5 minutes of quiet, then I can do that for 5 minutes. There's not a specific time frame or anything magical about whether it's 5 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. But I do like to allow long enough that I can that I can really quiet the noise of whatever upset I may have. And I don't wait until I'm upset to start meditating. But whatever it is that if I'm doing it first thing in the morning, then invariably there's something that seems so very important coming up in the day that I need to, that my mind wants to figure it out. And when I say figure it out, it wants to know precisely how it's going to go. I'll say this, they'll say that. Everybody in here is shaking their head. Yeah, that sort of thing. And it's kind of like, okay, this has got to stop. And once I get it quieted down and get my attention focused on God and my relationship with God, and I really like the affirmations that have been that were offered at the beginning of this, because I started off with God is love, and one of you guys personalized it that God loves me, and it's that relationship. One of my affirmations is, my God delights in me. Okay. That sort of relationship, because, when I am taking time to bring that to consciousness, then the truth about who and what I really am, begins to come from what my higher power perceives me to be, rather than what somebody else tells me. And that for me is just a real improvement in term, and this is where it gets tricky. My sense of self, my self-esteem, getting to the authentic self that I was created to be, rather than all the stuff that I made up, or that other people who may have been spiritually ill told me. And I can start growing towards that. So that's the guided meditation. I'm planning to kind of shift gears and talk about some stuff in preparation for step 12. But before we leave 10 and 11, I want to ask if anybody has any questions or comments. I did, Were most of you able to sense an internal shift as we went through that exercise? Was there any sense that you were making approaching something other than just listening to my voice, or? Because see, that's the, you know, this is not intended to be some sort of illusionist trickery. But what this really is, this is just one method, one way of opening a channel for you to have contact with your higher power. When I travel, particularly when I go someplace where there's an ocean close by, I really enjoy doing this, looking out over the ocean. I don't look into the rising sun. In fact, I really like to do it at what's called the false dawn. The sky's lighting up in the east, but the sun hasn't actually come up above the horizon. And just before the sun comes up, the water starts to take on, right at the horizon, takes on a funny glow. And somewhere between that and when it starts to come up to where I'm now, I'm burning my retina. I stop. Or I can do the same thing at sunset. Mountains. Lakes, but basically wherever I can shift my focus from the material world and all of the problems that I have imagined are going on, and just shift out of that and get into a conscious contact. Now, and this is not escapism. Because when I come back, there's still the reality, and instead of having to figure it all out all by myself, I find that I really and true I have a sense of peace and calm, and in terms of how I'm going to approach the problem, it may simply be that what comes to me is, you know, I really need to talk with Joe or Mike or whomever about this. It may be that I need to talk with one of the people at work about a problem at work. It may be whatever it is that I consider the problem that I perceived. My approach to it will be a lot more sane and. You know, it really and truly it works. And again, I want to make the point, this is one of the 12 steps. This is not a substitute for inventory, discussion with other people, making amends. This is just part and parcel of a spiritual way of life. Okay, we're going to start on the actual 12th step, working with others, tomorrow morning, and I want to give a little bit of history about what this working with others means to everybody in this room. Okay. You remember back in chapter 2, there is a solution. When no alcoholic had ever recovered, or that's not true, but the idea of a recovery program for alcoholism had never occurred. And there was a certain American businessman Do you remember that story?
Mm-hmm.
And he had treated with a doctor by the name of Carl Jung. And Carl Jung suggested to this American businessman whose name was Roland Hazard. That he needed to have a vital spiritual experience. And told him that I've been trying to make that happen for you, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your type. So we know what the solution is, we just don't know how to make it happen for you. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this the first weekend we were together, that Roland Hazard did not go to Europe with the intention of working with Dr. Jung. He wanted to work with Sigmund Freud, and Freud couldn't see him because he was full. Freud suggested he might want to see Dr. Adler, but Dr. Adler was also full. And Dr. Jung, who had had a falling out with Freud and Adler, was able to see him. And the argument that Carl Jung had with Freud and Adler was the idea that there was something other than just the human subconscious that affected human behavior. And it was a spiritual force, which he called the collective unconscious. And this idea, as any intelligent intellectual would, this man's ideas changed with time and experience. But he was the one. Freud or Adler would have never said anything about a spiritual experience because they did not recognize or accept the possibility of any spiritual force having an impact on human thought or behavior. So had Roland Hazard gotten to see the doctor he wanted to see, he would have never been suggested that he have a spiritual experience. And most likely, given the abysmal results of Freudian analysis for alcoholism, he probably would have died. And that would have been too bad for Roland. But Roland had this experience, and he went home. And his family was from New England. They had lots of money. And when he went home, there was a friend of his whose father was a judge in Vermont. And this guy, being a judge's son, and he knew Roland because the Hazards had a summer place up in Vermont. And during the summer, the judge's son and Roland got together during the summer and developed a childhood friendship that continued over the years. And the judge's son told Roland that one of their friends was in trouble for alcoholic insanity and was going to come before his father to be put away for life. And the friend's name was Abby Thatcher. Is the plot thickening for anybody yet? And the judge's son said, you know, my dad is, I've been trying to do everything I could for Abby. My dad doesn't have any confidence that I'm going to be able to do anything for Abby. But my father sure knows about your drinking and knows that something's happened, that you've gotten sober. And if you think that you and I can help Abby, my dad would listen to you. And you remember in Bill's story how his childhood friend, who was Abby Thatcher, was telling the story of how he was in court about to be committed for alcoholic insanity when two men showed up. Showed him the solution, which he came to pass on to Bill, if he would have it. Of course I would have it. I had to. I was desperate. Remember? Okay. Now, prior to this, there was a little doctor who loved alcoholics. That's the nickname that Dr. William Silkworth had. And you've read some of Dr. Silkworth's writings, right? He has an opinion that we read. And to most of the old timers who actually knew him before he passed on, he was known as Silky. And what Dr. Silkworth told Bill Wilson was about the nature of alcoholism. He explained to Bill why you can't even have even as much as one drink. And Bill said that this phenomenon of craving, and Bill said this made great sense in light of my experience. And he also said but remember, the craving doesn't start till after the first drink. Dr. Silkworth also pointed out the restless, irritable, and discontent which fuels the obsession that there's got to be some way that I can get the relief of the alcohol without the catastrophic events. Unfortunately, every time that we take the first drink, the craving starts and the cycle is pretty hopeless. So here we have people who first of all, Dr. Jung knows what the solution is, but he doesn't know how to bring it about. Roland Hazard comes back and he starts attending the Oxford groups. And the way the Oxford groups viewed their mission was that you change the leaders and you change society. Okay, they were not opposed to people on the Bowery being saved, but there were too many people on the Bowery for them to go save them all. So their idea was that you save the guys like Abby Thatcher, who have influence over hundreds of people. You get them fired up, and they fire up a couple of thousand, and it multiplies. And the idea is that eventually there will be this movement that will be available to the bums on the Bowery or wherever. So now Bill understands, if you will, the nature of the disease, which he got from Silky. And he recovers from alcoholism. Meanwhile, off in some godforsaken backwater little town called Akron, Ohio, there is a fairly rich family, and you may have heard of them. They used to make tires for Ford, called the Firestones. I don't think they do anymore.
No.
But at the time, they were making a lot of money. In fact, as you can imagine, Harvey Firestone and Henry Ford were pretty good buddies. Mm-hmm. You know, they were rich, they were in business and their businesses could profit each other. What's not to like? And Mr. Firestone had a son named Bud who liked to drink a lot. And he not only liked to drink a lot, he liked to drink a lot. A lot. And it got so desperate that he was basically not going to be able to take over his dad's company. And there was a salesman the old man took a liking to, and this guy was active in the Oxford groups. And on a trip, he got Bud to attend some meetings. Bud had a spiritual experience, and he stopped drinking on a spiritual basis. So the Oxford groups have sobered up two rich guys. Okay? And that in and of itself wouldn't be particularly remarkable and not really helpful to you or me, but it gets better. Because Mr. Firestone is so impressed with what's happened to Bud, he decides to invite some of the leaders of the Oxford movement to Akron, Ohio, to have a revival. And that particular revival in Akron is attended by a couple or several people that we will find very important in our saga. One is Harvey Firestone, soon to be former daughter-in-law. By a lady by the name of Henrietta Seiberling. Yep. And a local surgeon and his wife, Bob and Ann. And they probably were going incognito because they gave their last names as Smith. Now, in spite of the experience that Bud and Roland had, Dr. Bob, who also liked to drink a lot, was never able to get sober. And part of the reason was, first of all, he was afraid to let anybody know about his problem. And the other part was he was not willing to do what the Oxford group told him he had to do to get sober. And part of that was what we call it amends, they call it restitution. He was not willing to go through that. And he continued to drink. And his rationale was that if people knew that he was an alcoholic, that he'd lose his practice. Because, like most alcoholics, he knew that nobody else knew about his drinking. Finally, Henrietta, who was very concerned, Henrietta and Ann became very good friends. And by the way, everything in this big blue book, all the spiritual principles in this big blue book, can be found in Ann Smith's journal. Ann Smith is the spiritual foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? The 12 and 12 is in large measure affected by Ed Dowling. Okay? But this was written before Ed and Bill even knew each other existed. And everything, all the spiritual principles in here are in Ann Smith's prayer journal, and she was the one who presided over the morning meditations that when Bill and Bob finally got together. The rest of the story I think you know from here, and that is that Bill goes to Akron, the business deal falls through. He's desperate to talk. He realizes that he needs to talk to an alcoholic, another alcoholic, in order for him to stay sober. So it's important to remember that Bill made the call on Dr. Bob not to save Dr. Bob. Bill made the call on Dr. Bob out of the sense of desperation and humility that he needed to find another alcoholic, as much as that alcoholic might need him. And then he starts making phone calls. He ends up talking to a clergyman by the name of Walter Tunk, who helped him get in touch with Henrietta Seiberling. And he says, "I'm a rum hound from New York. I need another alcoholic that I can talk to so I can stay sober." And Henrietta says, "I've got just the case for you." Mm-hmm. And so Henrietta gets Dr. Bob and Bill together at the little gatehouse in Akron. Dr. Bob has a hangover of all kinds of hangovers because he was just passed out the day before, and he tells Ann, "We'll go, but in 15 minutes I want you to come pull me out of there. I'm sick. I've got to go home." 4 hours later, they came out of the study, and Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. And the reason is because even though he had the spiritual solution, it was only when Bill gave him the information about the hopeless nature of the disease that you have an obsession that guarantees that you will drink again. And once you drink, this allergy, this phenomenon of craving will make you drink until something intervenes. You'll pass out, run out of alcohol, whatever. But you won't be able to stop on your own. And so Dr. Bob said this was the first man who knew what he was talking about when it came to alcoholism. Dr. Bob invited Bill to stay with him. This is where they started having all these spiritual discussions, but Dr. Bob is still unwilling to make his amends. He decides to go to the AMA convention in Atlantic City, sure that self-knowledge will solve the problem. Any bets on how it worked out? He came back so drunk that he did not get off the station in Akron. He stopped at another station where a nurse that he had worked with took him in for a couple of days and then called and said, "Okay, he's here, and and he's not doing well." They get him back home and start trying to sober him up. And on June 10th of 1935. Dr. Bob had a surgery that he had to perform coming off of this horrific detox. And in order to steady his hands, Bill gave Dr. Bob one beer and drove him to the hospital. Now, the true hero of Alcoholics Anonymous is not Bill or Bob, it's that patient that Dr. Bob operated on that day. And the surgery was early in the morning. Noon comes, they haven't heard from Dr. Bob. Afternoon, evening goes around, and they know what's happened. He had the beer, the craving kicked in, he's off to the races again. Late that night, Bob comes home sober. He's been out driving around Akron making amends to all the people that he'd harmed, and he never drank again. And AA considers that to be Founder's Day, the day that Dr. Bob had his last drink. Now, remember when we read Bill's story, how he was in Towns Hospital when his friend showed for the last time when his friend showed up. Now he's detoxing in Towns Hospital, and Abby comes in and brings him the message that he got from Roland Hazard. Abby'd been sober for maybe a month or two when he goes down to this, he's down at this Calvary Street mission that Sam Shoemaker, one of the leaders in the American Oxford movement, has as a mission church. And one of the things they're telling folks is that if you want to continue with this, they call it a conversion experience, and if you want your life, you've got to go share what you found with others. And Abby realizes he's in New York. You know, he's now been sober for a month. Lights come on. Oh, that's right. I'm in New York. You know, Toto, we're not in Vermont anymore. I've got a friend that from up in Vermont that I used to drink with that I've heard is doing pretty poorly. I'll go see if I can call him. So he goes and makes the visit to Bill Wilson. For the next few days, Bill Wilson is all excited with what Abby has to say. The problem is he's still drinking. Remember, my gin would last longer than his rantings? It did. Bill goes down to Calvary Street Mission and drunk and decides to testify, you know. And at some point it all comes crashing down. He goes to Towns Hospital and you know, while he's there and just coming out of detox, Abby goes and talks with him. And what do they do in that one day? They go through the essentials of the program. Okay? Bill has been sober for 6 months. Nobody else has gotten sober, but Bill stayed sober, and he's in Akron. Dr. Bob gets sober on June the 10th, and within a week, they're going over, Bill and Bob are going over to find a fella by the name of Bill D, who is the his story's in the book too. This guy has been in and out of the hospital 6 times in the last 4 months. He's had GI bleeds from his drinking, and the last time they put him out of the hospital, he drank on the way home. And he's assuming that when they put him out this time, that he'll start drinking again pretty soon. So he says, you know, whatever you guys have, I'm hopeless. But they talked to him. They didn't talk to Bill about his drinking. Bill and Bob talked to Bill about their drinking. And Bill had the awareness. These guys know what they're talking about. And when his wife came the next day, he said, "Get my clothes. I'm ready to go home." And she figured, "Well, I'm just taking him home to die." And Bill and Bob showed up and says, "These are the two men I was telling you about." Bill stayed sober for the rest of his life. And if you've ever seen the picture that they have in a lot of AA clubhouses of the man on the bed and Bill and Bob talking to him, he's the man on the bed. So now we've got number three. And Dr. Bob had been sober less than 2 weeks, probably 1 week, when he and Bill went to call on Bill D. And I'm proud to point out that once upon a time, 2/3 of the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous was named Bill. So, there's a couple of points that I want to bring to your attention about this as it relates to what we've been doing this weekend and where we're going to go tomorrow. First of all, I've made this point over and over again. How when do you know that somebody's ready to work the steps? 30 days, 3 months, 6 months? There's one question you got to ask them. Do you want what we have, and are you willing to go any length to get it? Because if you are, you're ready to take certain steps. Ask the question. They'll say yes or no. If he says no, say, okay, when you do want recovery and you're willing to do what's necessary to achieve it, let me know and I'll show you how I recovered. Now, do you understand why it's important to say I'm a recovered sexaholic? How much more powerful is that than saying I'll show you how I'm recovering? Okay. Oh, you're still recovering. Is there anybody who ever gets well from this? That's who I want to. I want to talk to somebody who's gotten well, not somebody who's still having chemotherapy, vomiting 3 times a week, and having their hair fall out. I want to see somebody who's recovered. We don't have any of those people around here. Oh, I guess you guys don't have a solution. Okay. Because when you've recovered, I think there is a duty, the way that the first 100 saw the duty, to tell people, we've recovered, and we'll be happy to tell you precisely how we have recovered. They didn't stutter the first time. There's multiple times in that book when that's what they're saying. And we're here to offer that to you. So the first thing is, I agree, don't work the steps any more quickly than Bill Wilson, okay? Dr. Bob completed his step work the day that he had his last drink. Don't move it in, you know. And remember, they gave him his last drink because his hands were too shaky from the detox of the last debauch in Atlantic City. This was not a guy who waited a week, a month, 3 months, a year to start working the steps. As soon as he finished with the surgery, he went out and got busy with making the amends. And then, as soon as they could find a likely victim, because he called up the hospital, says my friend and I've got a cure for alcoholism, and the nurse who answered the phone said, well, have you tried it on yourself, Bob? He said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I have, and we're looking for a drunk that we can help. He says, we got one here. And they go down, and there's Bill D. and Bill is ready to start following the directions and leave the hospital that day. Okay? So when are you ready to start carrying the message? Okay? As soon as you've done the work. Okay? And what message are you carrying? Precisely what I've done. That's it. Okay. When you're working with others, I just want to make a point, because I heard a friend of mine talking about this, and I've done this, but his example was so crystal clear. He had a guy was dying in California, whose daughter knew this group of guys in Dallas, Texas. He was an alcoholic, and he was going down the tubes. She got him on a bus and put him on a bus from California to Dallas, Texas. That must have been a fun detox, okay? Just be glad you weren't sitting next to that guy on the bus. They get him off, you know, they clean him up. They get him start going to meetings. And like, 4 or 5 days later, he's sitting in the clubhouse. He's been coming to meetings, you know, each day. A couple of them are working with him, taking him through the steps. He's still you know, still just barely getting started on step four. And this this newcomer walks in to the clubhouse, brand new, and looks like 10 miles of bad road. And Chris turns to the fella and says, "Mike, go over and help that guy." He says, "I can't help him. I don't know anything." He says, "You know where the coffee is?" He says, "Oh, yeah." He says, "You know where the men's room is?" "Yeah." He says, "Tell you what, walk him over to the coffee counter, get him a cup of coffee, fill it only half full." There's a reason we do that with newcomers in AA. Show him where the bathroom is, and then invite him to come over and join us here at the table. And Mike gets up and goes and does that. And the guy gets his cup of coffee, walks over and joins him at the table. And Chris says that for the next hour, Mike owned that club. See, now this is no longer your home group. This is no longer your meeting. The newcomer now thinks of it as my home group, my meeting. This is where I will recover. This is where I will work the steps. When are you the most willing to do whatever it takes? When it hurts, okay? What are you doing for a newcomer? What are we doing for a newcomer when they walk in and they really are, at the end? Then everything's coming apart. There's no part of their life is working at this point. And we bring them in, we pat them on the shoulder and tell them, "You're going to be okay." First of all, that's a lie, because statistically speaking, they won't be okay. Okay? And then we sit around, we take them out for coffee and pie after the meeting. We just and they start feeling better. And they start thinking, "Oh man, I'm feeling better. Maybe I won't have to do those silly old steps. Maybe my case is different." Okay? I would argue that what we need to do is, as people walk in, that those of us who have done the work, who have been through the 12 steps, who have had the spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, who have been freely given a way of life that we certainly never earned or deserved, and we've been supported, and the message was brought to us through a chain of people that goes back to the people that I was mentioning before. And we have the opportunity to save this guy's life and to transform it into a life worth living. And if we don't do that, the disease will have his way with him. Since October of last year, two people in Middle Tennessee that I know of have died from this disease. This disease of sexaholism is just as fatal as drug addiction, alcoholism, whatever else. It will kill you. And I personally do not wish to give the disease one more victim. Okay, I cannot save them all. I know that. But I can make myself available to help the newcomer who walks in desperate for a solution. And Dr. Bob was asked, first of all, Dr. Bob worked with over 5,000 alcoholics during the time between the day he got sober and the day he died. And he had four reasons why he did it. One, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Four, because every time I do, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And tomorrow, when we get back together, we'll talk about how we do that. Okay, let's close with the Lord's Prayer.
Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works when you work it, and it won't when you don't.
I would like to thank you for listening to this episode of The Daily Reprieve, the best source for experience, strength, and hope for SA members. Please subscribe to this podcast to be alerted of new episodes. Please show your support by donating to The Daily Reprieve by going to donate.thedailyreprieve.com and choosing either monthly donations or a one-time donation by clicking Donate Now. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Daily Reprieve.